you have slowing occurring. We have truces in terms of the government shutdown. We have a truce in terms of the trade war with China.
The wage growth we're seeing is good, right? But it's not spectacular, and it's not enough to rush the Fed.
Saying the jobs number and the probability of wage hikes and inflation may force the Fed to make yet another policy shift.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
It was another explosive week for investors on Wall Street as more good news hits the markets. We got that unemployment report on Friday, the 100th consecutive month of adding jobs, but the unemployment rate dips up to 4% as the participation increases and the Fed pivots and goes soft on rate hikes. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Jonathan Krinsky. He says, not so fast. This could be a reflex rally. We could actually see another retest of those lows. You want to hear what he sees as one sector that's breaking out no matter what the news is. Mark Chandler will also be joining me in the bottom half of the show as we look at this dollar weakness as the Fed pivots. And Mark says gold is looking good here. Also joining me on the program will be Ryan Poplava as we take a look at what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss a topic that's not on the minds of most investors. Wall Street analysts are bullish on the stock market and the economy. And sure, you might hear minor concerns about the Fed, but most seem to think we're back to business as usual. We'll go over the leading economic indicators, market risks, credit spreads, and an inflating debt bubble. All of that coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Bear Market, or trading range. Now let's turn to Ryan Poplava for this week's market wrap.
Thanks, Chris. The week kicked off on a sour note on Caterpillar and Nvidia's earnings. Caterpillar, a bellwether on global growth, missed on earnings and guided full 2019 earnings per share below the average expectations of analysts. And the forecast for modest sales growth played right into slowdown concerns and the idea that the rally was due for a correction. Nvidia as well warned ahead of their earnings, which is they're due later this month, I think on the 14th. And they said on Monday their revenues will be 18.5% below their prior guidance due to weaker sales in gaming and data center segments. Now, semis have been rallying on previous earnings announcements last week. So this announcement revised that slower growth story and it hit a key area of the market being semiconductors. And you know what else this week? The recent South Korean industrial production number that came out was a decline of a monthly contraction of around 1.4% over the last month. And that also was weighed down by, they said, autos and semiconductors. So both of those stories kind of playing into each other. But I know that this will be a major topic for me to talk with Jonathan Krinsky, our technician, about, because we have seen semiconductors have put in some major bottoms. Now, Apple and Boeing's earnings turned the tide this week. Apple's other segments came to the rescue of the downturn in iPhone sales, with its services business showing strong 19% growth and a big whopping 62.8% gross margin rate. And that kind of really relieved a lot of investor sentiment on the stock, and we saw a major rally in Apple. Now, Boeing easily beat consensus revenue and earnings estimates and increased their guidance for the full year, with commercial airplane deliveries expected to be up 12% from last year. Now, they're going to be rolling out 895 to as many as 905 deliveries projected. And that's, like I said, a big jump over last year. When the employment data goes down, or you know, when we get sentiment is down in investors, that's not going to change the orders in airplanes. You know, that's just a real steady business with a great track record and backlog. Now, later in the week, Facebook also did much to beat the fear that was just essentially down in light of all of its negative publicity regarding its inability last year to protect data privacy. So between Facebook and Charter Communications, another name that was up big big in the communications sector. That whole sector had a huge relief rally, placing it as the sector leader on Thursday. Now, the big story wasn't just earnings. It was the Federal Reserve's policy shift from foe to friend that kicked things firmly back into the bull camp midweek. Now, we already knew policy had shifted to a patience role in interest rates due to Powell's comments on January 4th. But what we didn't know was how accurate the Wall Street Journal's article was last week on a balance sheet normalization possibly ending sooner and also possibly at a much larger balance sheet until this week. Now, here the statement from the Fed read this. The committee is prepared to adjust any of the details for completing balance sheet normalization in light of economic and financial developments. So just like with rates, the Fed basically flipped the idea on its head that they're on autopilot with its quantitative tightening policy, and that made it very clear they are not. So with the combined earnings reactions from Apple and Boeing, with the icing on the cake from the dovish Fed, that put the Dow Industrial Average as the first equity index to breach right above its 200-day moving average this week. Now, to finish this week, Chris, let me talk about a few economic reports. The consumer confidence report was out this week, and it was pretty bad. When we look at the gap between the present situation index of 169.6 versus the expectations index, forward-looking, which fell down to 87.3 in December, dropping 24%. Jeff Gundlach called it the most recessionary signal at present and the worst reading ever. Paul Hickey of Bespoke added that when the GAT gets above 50, recessions aren't far behind. Now, Lynn Franco, one of the directors at the conference board, believes this is just a temporary shock due to the stock market correction and the government shutdown situation, which has been temporarily relieved and isn't reading too much into that gap. Now, new home sales surged in November, bucking the trend, jumping 16.9% over October, yet still down 7.7% year over year. So it's still an issue, but a big surge kind of helped things out. Now, the jump in sales did come at the cost of median prices dropping just slightly. Now, the January employment report, it was big, showed an increase in participation and a tick up in unemployment because of that. But overall, we added about 304,000 jobs across the private and public sector, very interestingly, given the shutdown. But December was revised down quite a bit, down to 222,000 from 312. So still a good number. Anything above 200,000 is a great pace. Now, finally, looking at the PMI data, that's the Purchasing Managers Index data, we finally have the month-end report on China. China's manufacturing contracted down to 48.3, South Korea down to 48.3, Germany down to 49.7, Italy down to 47.8. So anything below 50, that's contraction territory. So it wasn't a great rating at all for those countries. And I believe Italy's prime minister came out and even said that they're in a recession. So while the Fed and earnings have done a lot to reverse the sentiment since December, there are still global growth concerns. And so far, no concrete trade agreement yet between the U.S. and China.
Ryan, thank you for that wrap-up report. As always, we do appreciate your insight into what moves the markets, and we'll look forward to hearing from you next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
What's going on in China is two things. One is that debt. There's a slowdown in M1 supply. They're starting to contract. You're starting to see that spillover effect. And then Trump comes in and he kicks off a tariff trade war. That takes a soft landing and pushes it into a hard landing. China is struggling. Every data point coming out of them, and we know that it's fudged data. It's as optimistic as it can be. You know, corporate profits are dying on the vine. Auto sales are contracting year over year for the first time since the 1990s. I mean, the country is falling apart.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
All right, let's welcome our technician for the week, Jonathan Krinsky, Managing Director and Chief Technician at Baycrest Partners. Jonathan, thanks for coming out on the show again. I think you were here a few months ago and things were radically different. So great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ryan. Good to be back.
Wonderful. Well, Jonathan, I'd like to let's just dig right in. We've got a number of things to discuss, a number of different asset classes, sectors, and trading groups. So let's just dig right in. Looking over your technical work here over the past couple of weeks, it appears with your work on the U.S. stock market right now that you are calling this rally a reflex rally. And what does that mean for some of our listeners? And do you believe this is a rally within an ongoing correction, or is this a new uptrend? Can you explain?
Yeah, well, it certainly is putting that thesis to the test, especially given the strength in the last couple of days, getting up to 2,700. But I think a couple of things to keep in mind. As of now, it's been an amazing month, up well over, I think, 7-8% for the month, but it's still an inside month, meaning it's still within the range of December. So we didn't take out December's low, we didn't take out December's high. So that's the first thing. And really, inside candles, regardless of the time frame, really just are not indicative of a change in trend, just a pause in trend. So you know, we're probably going to end up the month with an inside month. And then, you know, as we get into February, we should get some better context, you know, as we begin to maybe take out either December's high. Seems unlikely at this point, but eventually if we do take out December's low, which is down at 2346. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that we still have some longer term sell signals on momentum. We're still in a monthly MACD sell signal for the S&P. And then we're still below the 200-day moving average, which is flat. The slope is flat, so it hasn't really fully turned down yet. So those are just some of the kind of structural issues that I think are still in place. Flip side, of course, just we've seen some pretty good breadth surges. We had one of the highest readings in one-month highs on the S&P that we've seen in the last 30 years. So those tend to be pretty bullish looking out over the next year. So there's definitely some cross currents. You know, we don't think we're totally out of the woods yet, but certainly you do have to respect some of the ongoing improvement that we've seen in the U.S. markets.
Yeah, and I think in your newsletter, you really discussed this same exact situation happening back in 2015, where the market rallied like 13% off of that corrective low, almost retested it and took out those levels before then retesting again. Do you think that we're looking at a sort of a similar situation?
That's a good point. And it's, you never know what situation, what environment we're in, but I think looking at some historical context can just kind of put things in perspective. And yeah, if you go back to the rally off of the August and September 2015 lows, S&P got within a percent or two of its all-time highs in November of 2015. But what was notable is that the percentage of stocks, and if we're looking at something like the Russell 3000, which is 98% of all U.S. equities, the percentage of components within that index that got above their 200-day never really got above 50%, even though the index itself was almost back at a new high. And currently, as of yesterday, as of Wednesday's close, we're only about 32% there for the Russell 3000. So, I mean, yeah, we can continue to push higher. We can get above the 200-day moving average, and it still wouldn't mean that we're in, you know, a sustainable uptrend. But certainly, you know, getting that breadth number above 50 and really 60% is really what we'd want to see for a continued sustainable uptrend. I apologize if you're hearing a little background noise. I am sitting on the trading desk today, so it's a little louder than usual.
And right after the Fed, there's a lot of activity, right?
That's right.
Well, Jonathan, I in the context of this rally in maybe still within a correction and not really the beginning of a new bullish trend, what kind of asset allocation in stocks and bonds is Baycrest recommending to its, let's say, moderate investors as well as maybe its conservative investors, given this correction and the volatility in the market? What kind of exposure should a moderate investor have in stocks and in bonds?
Well, I mean, that's tough to answer. We, you know, we deal with institutional clients and they all have different risk parameters and time frames. You know, I think as we're talking about bonds, it's interesting to note that interest rates, particularly in globally, but in, particularly in Europe, are really breaking to the downside, which is a bit unusual given the risk on appetite for equities. But if you look at rates in Germany, France, Switzerland, and Spain, they're all testing multi-year lows, which is a bit surprising perhaps. And U.S. yields also continue to move a bit lower. 10-year yields today are at 263. So, you know, I think that's a little bit interesting. Again, you perhaps wouldn't expect such a rush into bonds given also the risk appetite we've seen in equities. So that divergence maybe will have to play out in the next couple of weeks. But as far as within U.S. equities, you know, there's definitely some spots that are doing well and what we'd consider relative strength areas being software. You know, software has been an area that's just been impervious, really, especially on a relative basis. You know, it never really saw much relative weakness, even in the sell-off we saw last quarter. So, you know, that seems to be one of the leadership areas. And then there's kind of the areas that, if we're talking about first in, first out, some of the areas that kind of peaked early last year in 2018, and a lot of names maybe didn't make new lows with the market in December. So some of the home builders would fall into that category, and they've continued to kind of act well, kind of look more like a basing process. Maybe some of the semiconductors you could put in there. And then if we're talking about globally, emerging markets also, the EM ETF, for instance, did not make a new low in December with the S&P. So, yeah, there's certainly areas that look to be kind of stabilizing, basing. It's too early still to probably call the all clear for it, by our work anyway, for the S&P, but there's definitely some pockets within there to look at.
Yeah, I think in your newsletter, Jonathan, you said that correlations were dropping. And that maybe it's a time to separate the leaders from the laggards. What do you mean by that? I think you already mentioned a couple of groups, the software sector, the semiconductors as well. And specifically on the semiconductors, I've been following a lot of work going on there. Texas Instruments earnings out, where they showed communications where revenue growth was. However, industrials and autos, they weren't. And just recently, we saw that Korea's December industrial production showed its second month of contraction, down 1.4%, weighed down by autos and semis, is what they said. So in that in line, I'm seeing it as well as you, that some of these semiconductors are starting to put in maybe some basing patterns or double bottoms. How do you reconcile between fundamentally, we're seeing the slowdown is still happening, yet some of these chart patterns are saying it might be bottoming?
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes the best way to look at things is when price action can't go down on bad news, then that's usually a bullish tell. And we've seen a lot of that. I think some of the semiconductors certainly had that in the last few weeks. You know, you could look at even Apple, which certainly is not a semi, but has plenty of exposure and read through. I think when they pre-announced in early January, that looking back on it, that was kind of the buy the news on the negative announcement. So sometimes when stocks can't go down on bad news, that's a tell. But yeah, there's definitely some divergence within sectors. And I'll even, you know, talk about the banks, which kind of led off the lows, off the December lows. They are now starting to roll over a bit as the yields globally come in. So we're seeing the bank index actually relative to the S&P having one of its worst days in the last year today. So definitely, you know, a lot of bifurcation. If you want to take the bullish case of that, it's that it's just this ongoing rotation. And, you know, if that continues, that would ultimately be a good thing, meaning when one sector takes a breather, there's another sector that picks up the slack. And that's kind of what we're seeing today.
It was sort of the opposite back in October, where leadership was technology. And then all of a sudden, with all of the subcomponents of Apple, all the suppliers coming out and warning, we saw technology lose its leadership and there was nobody else there to take up the slack.
Exactly.
So, yeah, speaking of financials, they're not participating, like you said today. Is that a warning sign that this is just a rally within the context of a correction or a bear market?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. What I will say is that the fact that they're rolling over a little bit today is from a pretty logical spot. sometimes we look at a volume at price chart, meaning where has the most amount of volume occurred at each given price level, right? Most people look at volume on a time parameter, but sometimes it can be valuable to look at it at a price level. And we noticed that over the last couple of years, if we're looking at the KBE ETF, which is the S&P Spider S&P Bank ETF, the most amount of volume over the last couple of years has traded around the 43.5 level on the KBE. And if you look at a chart, that's almost exactly where the rally stalled out. So it's doing everything you would expect it to do if in fact we are in a rally within a downtrend. And again, the KB Bank ETF is by our work in a downtrend. It's below a declining 200-day moving average. Could this be the start of a base? You know, could we be putting in a bigger inverted head and shoulders pattern? Sure. But, you know, at this point, it's too early to tell. All we know is that we had a very severe sell-off. We had a snapback rally, and we're now failing at some logical resistance. So, you know, that's what we're watching now. We, you know, again, we'll take it one day at a time, but, you know, so far there's nothing that indicates in the bank sector anyway that it's doing anything out of the norms for a rally within a downtrend.
So, Jonathan, looking at the Fed, maybe that's playing a big role in what's going on with interest rates. They've softened their economic commentary, lowered their inflation outlook, and transitioned to patience. How is this affecting? We've talked about yields are falling right now on that. You talked about EM, Europe yields are falling on soft economic news, maybe also related to the Fed lowering interest rates projections. How are you seeing this play out in the dollar? And we're also seeing gold putting in some major bottoming patterns here. What's your outlook on the dollar and gold for now?
It's good you brought that up because gold's certainly been a focus for us for a little while. The dollar is interesting. I think if we look at it purely from a technical perspective, it's clearly losing some upward momentum. You know, I think anecdotally and just looking at some of the sentiment, it does kind of seem like maybe people are too bearish on the dollar, given that it's still in a pretty strong uptrend from last year's lows, and it's just kind of testing its rising 200-day moving average. So purely technically, it still looks okay, but certainly the weakness over the last couple of months has helped commodities, particularly gold, along with emerging markets. So I think our view on gold is stronger, being bullish, than our view on the dollar is. So I think the dollar can kind of chop around. If we're looking at the DXY index, you know, maybe it breaks down to 94 as the lower end of the range. 96 to 98 is kind of the upper end of the range. So as it pulls in a little bit, again, that should be bullish gold and commodities. But if we're talking about gold on its own, there are a couple of things that we'd highlight. I think tactically or short term, it is probably a little extended. You know, we've had a pretty good run off the December lows. And then even in the last couple of days, we've gone from kind of 1275 to 1325. So maybe we see a little bit of pause there. But if we look, take a step back and look at the, kind of a multi-year weekly chart, putting in a pretty good base. So I think ultimately the key resistance to get through is kind of 1350 to 1375. So I think maybe we'll struggle with that area over the next few weeks, even a couple months. But I think as we look ahead over the next couple quarters, I do think gold can move higher. And it doesn't have to necessarily mean that the dollar rolls over. Dollar and gold do have a fairly high correlation over the near term, but over the longer term, it's not necessarily that strong. So we are favorable on gold. Silver as well is improving. A lot of the gold miners have continued to improve. So I do think that's a spot where it can kind of give you some uncorrelated exposure from most equities. And it's a good spot to, I think, to put some money, some of these gold miners.
And Jonathan, I'd like to finish off with something you said earlier, tying into emerging markets. You said that when bad news comes out and it doesn't move the needle down and maybe you're bottoming, that maybe that's a positive change at the margin. We're seeing that in emerging market debt, as well as emerging market equities, even despite flash purchasing managers index data that came out last week on Japan at flat, China declining. What do you see here going on in emerging market equities as well as debt?
Yeah, so I guess if we were to make the bullish case, you know, not just for emerging markets, but kind of equities globally, we would say that while the U.S. markets peaked in last December, last September, global equities and emerging market equities actually peaked last January and pretty much sold off pretty steadily from last January till last October. So they, again, if we talk about this first in, first out analogy, you know, you could say that they were in a 9 to 12 month bear market, while broadly speaking, U.S. equities were only in a 3 month bear market. So again, if we were to make the bullish case there, that would be it, is that we went through a 9 month distribution process, and then we started to see some bullish divergences. We started to see stocks, you know, not go down on bad news. That would be the bull case. So I think for us, the bull case in EM is easier to make than it is in U.S. broadly speaking. And, you know, we're above the 200-day on the emerging markets ETF today for the first time really since last May. And, you know, there's definitely been more of a buzz and more talk about, you know, are emerging markets making the turn? So that's kind of how we view things there. And we're also seeing that in some global markets in general.
Yeah, I'm in agreement, Jonathan. I'm hearing the talk as well, seeing it pretty widespread. A consensus seems to be building in that area. Well, Jonathan, is there anything else that I didn't cover that you really want to highlight before we end our call?
No, I think that's it. I mean, I guess one of the other areas that we continue to watch, not areas, but intermarket keys that we like to watch from a sentiment perspective is the put call ratios. And this kind of gives a gauge of sentiment, tells you, are people generally more optimistic or more cautious? And, you know, we kind of look at a 10-day moving average of some of the put call ratios on the equities and indices. And those have moved quite a bit lower in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So whereas, you know, if we were talking about a 10-day of the composite put call ratio in December, we were around 125, 126, which is pretty high, meaning a lot of puts were being bought relative to calls. We're now down to 0.93, which is about as low as we've been in the last 3 to 4 months. So certainly, as you would expect, when markets go higher, people get more optimistic, they start reaching for upside, and that can be, you know, a sign for concern. But so far, it hasn't mattered. We'll see if it matters in the coming weeks, but just keep an eye on that from a sentiment perspective.
That's a great point, Jonathan. We will do. And again, Jonathan Krinsky, Managing Director and Chief Technician at Baycrest Partners. Thanks again for coming on the show, Jonathan. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate the time, and I look forward to being back.
Sounds good. We'll see you next time, Jonathan.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
There is a very solid chance that more Arctic air is going to dip down into the Corn Belt regions, into the Northern Plains, into northeastern U.S., and most definitely into the Prairie provinces or eastern Canada. So once again, not the negative 51 degrees that felt like 71 degrees with wind chill sort of temperatures, but an increase in snow activity, an increase in colder temperatures, and we're anticipating that to occur throughout February.
Well, the Fed came this week, and it looks like a pivot coming from the Federal Reserve. Certainly a Fed that is sounding much different this January than it did last fall. Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler from Bannockburn Global Forex. He's a managing partner. Mark, let's begin with the dollar and what happened this week with the Fed. It was sounding very hawkish. If you listen to Powell last September and December, doesn't seem like the same guy that's talking now. What changed his mind?
Well, I think that what's changed is the rhetoric. And I think that he says it's these cross currents. I think that the data set changed and the Fed tempered its views. But I think it's the views that have been tempered. It's not their actions. The balance sheet is about, they're saying they're more flexible about it. The balance sheet is still going to be reduced by, aimed to be reduced by $50 billion dollars a month. And the policy of the Federal Reserve being a patient, it's been signaled already. And so I think that what we saw happen is to the dollar is that the dollar had already begun weakening. You know, it had really, give you an example, the euro last week after the ECB met, the euro had traded below a 113, 115 trading range in which it's been stuck in. It broke out to the downside and we snapped right back into it as the euro recovered ahead of the Federal Reserve meeting, as people expected, a fairly dovish Fed. I think that's what they delivered. There's been some follow through, But the euro is really poked above 115 and people came in and sold it. So I think they were still stuck for the most part in this 113, 115 trading range.
Now, one of the things that has helped to strengthen the dollar is obviously a stronger U.S. economy. We've had interest rates here. I mean, our treasury yields until recently were looking like junk bonds when you compare them to overseas, like, for example, German 10-year bunds. Mark, does the dollar weaken further here? I mean, it had a nice run from April last year, but given the fact that the Fed is going on pause, or at least temporarily, does the dollar go lower?
Well, I think that right now, I think you're right. The market, I think, has a, when you look at what analysts are forecasting, I think most people are now looking for the dollar to go lower, even before this pivot by the Federal Reserve. But here's what I think is going to happen. I think that before the Federal Reserve does anything to its balance sheet, I mean, changing its balance sheet course, we will see the European Central Bank ease policy. And they're going to ease policy by extending long-term loans to the banks. And this will help prevent their balance sheet from constricting. It'll be seen as another way to help out the banking system. At the same time, this is going to be happening in Europe. Look at what the Chinese have announced. They announced this program where the Chinese banks can issue these perpetual bonds, swap these perpetual bonds with the People's Bank of China, with the central bank, for bills. And then they could use the T-bills to do what they need to for repo operations and the like. In effect, this is a recapitalization of Chinese banking system, and it's another way of easing policy, of easing financial conditions. So the pivot to the Fed, the pivot from the Fed, was on this idea that these cross currents might be threatening the robustness of the U.S. economy. And those cross currents, I'm suggesting, are slowly going to be lifted. So by the time we get to the middle of the year, the market's going to be back thinking about Federal Reserve rate hikes, while the ECB and the Central Bank of China are easing policy.
So right now, you've got three of the world's major banks easing policy, the Fed, the ECB backing up, and then, of course, what's going on in China, because China just reported some of the slowest economic growth in three decades. What about this trade war, Mark? Do you expect that to be resolved? Because, I mean, I'm just looking. We're in the middle of a presidential election cycle. No president wants to go into an election with, let's say, a slowing economy, or worse, a recession or bear market or trade conflicts. How much of this trade war between the U.S. and China is impacting the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think two things when it comes to China affecting the world. One is the slowing down of China itself. And the other is, as you mentioned, these trade tensions with the U.S. It's a tough call. My sense would be that it's going to play out to the very end of the month. President Trump and Xi will meet again. I think that they'll eventually compromise. And basically, it seems to me what we're going to get is very much what we had before, what we could have had before without the drama. And that is for the Chinese to say, fine, they will buy more of U.S. goods. And these are going to be primarily raw materials and commodities. Happy, good stuff for farmers, agriculture, energy, perhaps services, and and in exchange, we'll also get some kind of verification process. What could that possibly be? But the continuation of what we saw under past presidents, some kind of regular meeting between officials from the U.S. and China, which the Trump administration had canceled. So I think we'll end up getting back to square one, where China promises to buy more of our goods, and maybe there's some extra effort China does to crack down on intellectual property rights violations. Well, you can see what the U.S. is doing, taking care of it on a company basis, even if they can't get the country to help out.
So as we see the dollar weaken here, let's talk about another commodity, and that's gold. It looks like gold is breaking out. It's above 1,300 on the day you and I are speaking. It is breaking out once again. What's your views on gold here?
Yeah, no, gold has had a good run here. And it's interesting, too, partly what's happened, I think, is that the opportunity cost of owning gold is the interest rates, and interest rates have fallen. And so I think that's like the remarkable thing is how well gold has held up in the face of other commodities, except perhaps oil, and that it's coming at an environment of still very low inflation, but lower interest rates.
So as you look at gold and as you look at commodities, of course, they move inversely to the dollar. We also have, on the day you and I are speaking, oil prices moving back up. Let's throw out something. Let's just say that we have this weakening period
which we seem to see or has been characteristic of this economic recovery, Mark. We slow down in the fourth quarter and the first quarter of the year, and then it picks up in the second and third quarter. So let's go back to your thesis that, okay, they're on pause right now, but if this economy picks up, let's say in the second quarter, the third quarter, we see oil prices start to move, inflation starts to pick up, the stock market starts to go up, does the Fed change its rhetoric?
Yeah, no, that's what I think is going to happen. I think the Fed's going to have to prepare the market. Because what the Fed basically did is they didn't adopt an easing bias. They just went to what we used to call a neutral bias, not telling us which direction the rates will go, dropping the risk bias statement. So what I'm looking at is gold, because I'm thinking that we can go to 1350, but I'm hesitant about trying to chase gold up here, because as we're talking, gold is above the top of its Bollinger Band. And it's telling me that this run up from, say, 1280 or so to 1325 or so is really has really extended the technicals. And I think a lot of news is priced in now. A dovish Fed, the very dour Draghi from the ECB, the stuff that's happening in China. So I think that our information set as investors is not going to be really added much in the coming days. We're going to have to get a resolution of Brexit. We need a resolution of these trade tensions. And I think, you know, we still don't know about what's going on with the U.S. government. 3 weeks is this period in which the government is funded for. So I think my sense is that a lot of good information is known, and I'd be hesitant about chasing markets on big moves and breakouts, like it looks like gold or the dollar might be having.
Let's talk about some other asset classes. I want to talk about oil, and I want to talk about the stock market, because if you look at the precipitous drop that we saw in both assets, both in oil prices and then also in the stock market, we have this V-shaped bounce back. I mean, if you think about it, Mark, oil was in a bull market, and then in a period of 2 months, we lost 40% of its value, and in 3 weeks, it's up over 25%. I've been following the oil markets. I haven't seen anything like this in three decades.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on oil, but I really like this market. I mean, here's my sense. So I'm looking at the March contract, and it's possible that you have a head and shoulders bottom in there, and we got to get over this 55.50. And today we're trading right now about 55 and a quarter or so. 55.50, I think, is the high. From back in November, the neckline comes in there, and if it is a head and shoulders bottom, we go up to $65 or so, and the 63.5 is where the FIBO 61.8% retracement comes in. So what I'm really saying here, to cut the technical mumbo jumbo, is if we get much above, say, 55.50, we can go up another $10. The price of oil, and unfolding that scenario you had about a rising oil market and the dollar. The S&P is also, I find interesting. I had been thinking that I never really trusted the sell-off in December. I thought it was very exaggerated. But I've been looking for us to get up to 2,700 since since the new year began. And we're testing that now here at the end of the month. We're making the highs for the month. It's the highest since early December. And this too looks like the V-shaped bottom you described. And hopefully on pullbacks, we hold above 2,600. I get more nervous about it now that we've made this bounce back, that we need to still go probably sideways until we get more data, which we couldn't get because the government was closed. More data, but especially here in Q1, to really get us much above, say, 27.5.
So as an investor right now, we have some positive trends in gold, commodities such as oil, in the stock market itself. What would you be doing as an investor? Would you be sort of maybe sitting on the gains that you have, deploying some cash, or wait for another entry point?
Yeah, no, I'm really stuck myself. I mean, I think that I haven't done anything. I sort of rode down the wave in the losses in December, thinking that they would come back. We're coming back here, back to like where we sort of like averaged for most of that fourth quarter last year. I just sort of want to be patient here, like the Federal Reserve, perhaps, and waiting to really just see how things unfold. I think that I'm not as negative as many people seem to be on the U.S. economy, that we're on the verge of a recession. I do think the economy is slowing, but only towards trend growth, while I think that other countries seem to be in worse shape. And so I think expectations are so low, it's hard to disappoint us to the downside. So I'm waiting to see how things fold out here. But I think maybe it becomes more of a stock picker's market rather than the ETFs and passive investing, thinking about what are those sectors that could sustain even if we're in the late cycles.
Mark, what about the risk of more, let's say, political discord in Washington? We just had one of the longest shutdowns in recent memory. I think, we went 35 days. They're supposed to get back together within 3 weeks. We have the debt ceiling coming up, I believe, in March. This is a presidential election cycle, so I just can't see any cooperation between both sides. What about political discord and the risk it poses for the market?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to see either side having an interest in enforcing another government closure. I don't see how they work it out, but neither side, neither extreme position is going to get what they want. And it's not really about principles here. After all, I mean, I think Trump is right. There is a lot of fence and walls built along the border. It's not complete. And at the same time, the Democrats don't want it to be just cover for a symbol of a broader policy that they don't like. But I think both sides, of course, believe in the principle of border security. So I don't know how it gets played out, but I do worry about that. And I think that if we were to have another government closure, it's possible that one of the rating agencies who had already threatened to take away the U.S. AAA, you know, would make good on its threat.
Let's move to another section that could be at risk if the economy slows down. In this economic recovery, Mark, we saw a lot of debt issued in the corporate world, and a lot of it is triple B. What happens to that debt when, let's say, the economy slows down and maybe some of these companies start getting downgraded?
Yeah, I know. That's, you know, what you say is I've heard many people talk about this as one of the big threats to financial stability. And a lot of it, I think people are scared by what happened with GE. I think this becomes a risk, but my sense is still that they were far enough away from the big imbalances that would really trigger a systemic problem. I can imagine that there is on like a local, you know, on an individual company-specific basis, it's worth analysis. But on a systemic level, I'm not so sure that poses that kind of threat. But I think it's something to be monitoring because I think we need to be attuned to what happens. What are the consequences of low interest rates for a long period of time? Many people think that the Federal Reserve killed business recoveries or expansion cycles. But the last couple, you think about it, the great financial crisis was not triggered by a too tight of Fed. The tech boom was not triggered by too tight of a Fed. The savings and loan crisis was not triggered by too tight of a Federal Reserve, but quite the opposite of the financial market problem. So I think we need to be particularly sensitive to imbalances as they rise in the financial sectors.
So right now, you're probably a lot more optimistic than some of the analysts that we've had here, but you do have some cautions. So if you were to make bets, is there anything that looks attractive to you?
I mean, I still really like the idea that the market has overreacted to the dovishness of the Federal Reserve, and does not appreciate what challenges lie ahead for Europe and for China. And so my own view, I would be taking advantage of this dollar pullback here since the FOMC statement, and in some fashion, increase my dollar weighting, whether it is taking advantage of it for short-term speculators to sell the foreign currencies at the top end of their ranges, like the Aussie or the Euro, or to hedge foreign receivables for small businesses.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, you've written a number of books and you also have taught courses. Tell our listeners how they can follow the things that you do.
I have a Twitter handle, Mark Making Sense. It comes from my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. My second book is called Political Economy of Tomorrow. That's available on Amazon. Other electronic book places, though it's paperback. I do have a blog called Mark to Market. It's updated every day. And I do respond to emails, and if people reach out and want to exchange some views, happy to be engaged.
All right, Mark, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best, and we'll talk to you once again.
Good. Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
And in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss a topic that's not on the minds of most investors. Wall Street analysts are bullish on the stock market and the economy. And sure, you might hear minor concerns about the Fed, but most seem to think we're back to business as usual. We'll go over the leading economic indicators, market risks, credit spreads, and an inflating debt bubble. All of that coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, Bear Market, or trading range.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.